You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 26, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Pepper, author of Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. And meanwhile, just breaking, NBC is reporting Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer to retire. Stephen Breyer to retire.
Breyer retire.
Breyer retire.
We could have come up with a rhyme before the show, but
it just happened.
Happened too quickly.
Meanwhile, Democrats rushing Ukraine defense bill through the House as U.S.-Russia talks continue. Russia military drills continue. San Jose, California, first in the country to institute gun ownership requirements like liability insurance. The New York mask mandate reinstated, at least temporarily. The EU relaxes travel rules for vaccinated and COVID-recovered peoples. Nancy Pelosi announces she will seek re-election again. Unclear whether she will keep her pledge, her promise, her solemn swear to step down from leadership. Crypto collapse cost $1 trillion in wealth. Good news, tulips holding steady at 118 per stem. EPA finds soot deadlier than thought. Biden administration looks to up standards. Deaths outpace birth in Michigan for the first time ever with COVID's help. Mark Kelly does not support the censure of Kyrsten Sinema. Jessica Cisneros' challenge of Henry Cuellar got a bit of a boost the other day. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Big news about Stephen Breyer. Just got the word. We will be talking about that in the days to come. Obviously, there's going to be hearings that need to happen before, I guess, really, basically a year at this point. But I imagine they're going to move quite quickly.
They should, given the lessons that they should have learned from.
Indeed. And we will see. We will talk about the speculation over the next day or two as to who might replace Stephen Breyer.
Obama. Remember those rumors?
Oh, God. There's no way.
That hard.
There's no way he wants a job where he has to show up every
day.
Oh,
my God. He wants to be windsurfing with the virgin guy. What's his name?
No way.
Branson.
Now, I know that you gave me a look when I said that thing about tulips. Did you know what I was referencing?
No. Okay. But I do love tulips.
All right. Yes. Well, no, we're not. I'm not getting you tulips. I'm sorry.
Well,
Emma Vigeland's here.
Yeah,
yes,
hi.
Sorry.
And I love tulips.
Back, when was this? In the 1600s?
Yeah, around the early 17th century.
Tulips, for whatever reason, became almost like a currency.
The experiments in genetics were really taken off at that point, and you could, you know, get certain really specialty types of tulips. And from around, and also you have British exploration, so they're getting tulips and different types of things from all sorts.
In terms of the color, or?
Yeah, exactly, the color, the structure, and so people went crazy.
They went crazy for them, and they became like you know, sort of like gold. I mean, they became incredibly valuable. And I don't know exactly how it worked. Like, obviously, tulips don't maintain themselves for next, you know, but they, you know, back and
the seeds do.
The seeds do. And and there was a period of time where there was just this massive market for tulips. And then all of a sudden, there wasn't.
Sounds like the crypto boom.
Well, that's why exactly. I raised that. Now,
is that what you said?
Yeah, I mean, look, the bottom line is, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with crypto, and I can imagine that there's going to be, they're going to find some very good uses for blockchain technology that won't involve, like, silly pictures of an ape or something like that.
Ugh.
But
did you see that video of Paris Hilton and Jimmy Fallon?
Just absolutely ridiculous. And I was like, I didn't know who Paris Hilton was. I was like, what? But
that's insane.
And well, I don't know if I ever saw her like on video. I think I like saw pictures, but
right.
I don't know.
That was a huge.
Well, other people did.
That was a big deal.
Oh right, well, she had like a sex video, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, but nevertheless, I did not see that one either, sadly. But the bottom line is that I'm sure there's value to and you know, look, I have baseball cards, and I'm going after my old albums, and I'm looking up some of these albums are worth some money.
Yeah.
And you know, but it ebbs and flows, and I guess it's conceivable at one point we will have digital currency. In some ways we do. It's called a debit card. and so it is a digital currency in that way. But right now, as far as I can tell, these cryptocurrencies are, you know, they're commodities.
They're beanie babies.
that have, you know, maybe a little bit more value than others. Because
it's a speculative bubble.
Yeah.
People are trying to inflate the price and sell it to the next guy to get more cash.
We'll see. All right. We're going to play two clips right now that I think capture the insanity of the moment in many respects. Here is Martha McClallum. Now, with the exodus that we've seen from Fox News, I think Martha McClallum is like the big news person mm-hmm. there, right? She's sort of the
and
Walter
Dana,
Cronkite.
Dana Perino kind of, right? Maybe
no,
not even.
She's just a commentator. She's never, I don't think she's ever done
oh,
any
really?
Reports. She was a spokesperson for Bush.
I'm sorry, I get some of these blonde women a little confused
it's okay.
in my mind.
It's okay. It's okay. But Martha McClallum, I believe, is now like essentially the Walter Cronkite of Fox News. And here she really digs in. You got to love it when you listen to the guest and you ask the questions that, you know, based upon what the guest, she wants to know why we haven't been doing. And if you pay attention to Fox News or the right wing, and all these people are trying to make money off of COVID clicks. One of the big things that they've sort of pivoted to now is like therapy. Why isn't there more therapies, treatments? And I'm not sure where this has come from. Like,
it's the monoclonal antibodies thing. So
right.
Two of the monoclonal antibodies don't work for the Omicron, and so they've taken them off the, you know, the advisory, and there's only one left. So there's a lot less monoclonal antibodies to go around, and they're acting as if this is some conspiracy.
Well, I mean, we were told that the monoclonal antibodies work.
And
now you're telling me they don't?
Yeah, well, that's
I'm
the problem
over
for Rogan.
It. I'm done.
I'm done with
I'm
monoclonal
not,
antibodies.
Forget it. Forget it, Omicron. I'm not. I'm done playing.
You switched
with
it up
you.
On me, so I'm breaking
not,
up with you.
Not fair. But here's McClallum asking this doctor, and she did not get the answer that she wanted.
So here's the question. When you have nearly 2,000 people dying in a day, would these people have survived if they were given these antiviral treatments or perhaps steroids that would lower the inflammation in their bodies? Why are so many people still dying given everything that we now have in the treatment cabinet?
Pause it for 1 second. Pause it, pause
the biggest
it.
Problem
pause,
is
pause,
still-
pause it, pause it. I want you to go back a little bit. But can you imagine all the doctors that are watching this and they're going, why didn't we try the anti-inflammation things, the steroids? God.
I should have looked a little harder in my apothecary for the right treatment.
That's what frustrates me so much about this is, like, it's couched as if it's a media critic. Like, look at the liberals. They don't want to, entertain all sorts of, like, ivermectin and all this stuff. It's really, like, But it's an accusation against all doctors, as if they're overlooking things that would help patients.
Except for the one or two out of every, 1,100 that are brave enough to give someone ivermectin. But here we go.
Treatments or perhaps steroids that would lower the inflammation in their bodies. Why are so many people still dying given everything that we now have in the treatment cabinet?
The biggest problem is still going to be unvaccinated individuals getting hospitalized and dying in the hospital. That's what I see. I was in the hospital yesterday. That's the predominant type of person that's getting severe infection. Some of these individuals come to light too late to be able to benefit from the one monoclonal antibody that does work against the Omicron variant. And antivirals are very hard to find. They're rationed, and you need to have some high-risk conditions. But also, the fact is, some of these patients have been in the hospital for some time, and they may have been infected with Delta. But the primary way to keep yourself alive from COVID-19, especially if you're high-risk, is to be vaccinated. Then you don't really get into that situation. But we do have more tools. We are giving these patients all steroids. We're giving them remdesivir, immune modulators when they're in the hospital. But sometimes it's not enough because they're so severely ill and they have so many high-risk factors.
Yeah, I understand. Well, when are we going to get to the point, some people say next month, where these antivirals are readily available so that as soon as someone gets sick, within the first day or two, their doctor can write a prescription and get them on this right away?
I mean, I'm going to completely ignore what you say is the way to save lives. But 30 days from now, or as I just mentioned, 60,000 deaths from now, at least, maybe we'll have therapies that will be available more readily. Is that right, doctor? I mean, just insanity. But it doesn't end there, because Fox is a 24-hour news channel.
Right. McCallum's, though, is that supposed to be the real news, as you say? And yet it's indistinguishable from the opinion in terms of what they're actually pushing for that's on other points in the program.
It's a little more subtle than what we'll see when we get to Tucker a little bit later in the evening, the same day.
We're at a very dangerous moment, Tucker. And, I'm not exaggerating. I think this is probably the most important appearance I've had with you in the last 2 years.
Oh,
It is completely clear now that the vaccines don't really work at all against Omicron. In these highly vaccinated and highly boosted countries, rates of infection are incredibly high, and rates of serious disease and death are also rising. The Israelis are predicting that they're going to have more serious cases than they ever had at the peak last year.
Pause it. Now, why might that be? Because it is that much more virulent, that much more contagious. So even though the percentage of people who get seriously ill from Omicron is less, the sheer number of people who catch it is so much higher, so many multiples higher, that we're still, I think, 3,000 plus was our peak, but we're up there, 2,200 over 7 days. But here's Berenson talking about how the vaccine doesn't, and incidentally, it does provide some protection against infection.
Yeah.
And then it obviously provides a tremendous amount of protection against death.
He doesn't specify which population is being hit hardest by serious illness and death, and it's the unvaccinated.
Continue.
At least yet.
High, and rates of serious disease and death are also rising. The Israelis are predicting that they're going to have more serious cases than they ever had at the peak last year. And the idea that we would solve this with another booster is just off the charts insane. I have not said this to you before because I'm pretty careful, and I'm pretty careful with the data, but these vaccines, these mRNA vaccines, the mRNA COVID vaccines need to be withdrawn from the market now. No one should get them. No one should get boosted. No one should get double boosted. They are a dangerous and ineffective product at this point against Omicron. The spike that they make your body make that you then produce antibodies to is not the Omicron spike. And earlier today, Tony Fauci said, we're not going to give people monoclonal antibody products, because the first generation products, because they don't work against the Omicron spike. The same logic applies to these mRNA vaccines and giving people boosters. Even if in the very short term it knocks down infection rates, there's a boomerang effect, and that's what they're seeing in all these countries. We are at a dangerous moment, and these products need to be withdrawn.
When you say, so you say they're ineffective, and that's demonstrable to anybody who lives in this country. Everyone you know who's had it, you know, has had COVID. Most of them are fine.
I mean, it, you know, just whatever, 12 hours earlier, 10 hours earlier, 8 hours earlier on the exact same network, you had a doctor saying we need to vaccinate people because it's the one thing that we can help keeping people from dying.
It's despicable. I think it's also really gross when people comment on when Berenson gets, you know, banned from Twitter or whatever for spreading this kind of, you know, awful misinformation. Just comment on, like, isn't it bad that he got suspended? And I think, like, even if you are a free speech absolutist, you should make the comment on he's a raving lunatic that's getting people killed. And if you think that he should be allowed to continue, like, uncensored, then just own that part of it.
I mean, there's, like, these platforms do have a responsibility to mitigate negligent homicide, for example. And, like, that's basically what the Fox anchors and the...
I don't understand how he gets away with this without somebody coming and suing. I really don't.
Well, you can't prove causality, yeah, right?
So how do we do class action lawsuits in this country? Do we allow a whole class of people to say, hey, I was, my family, my dad watched Hannity and all these folks and decided not to get the vaccine because of it. Can I get some money for it? I think I would like to see that, frankly. I think after a certain point of, after a certain level of, like, media power, companies should be accountable for that stuff.
I would think. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. And when we come back, David Pepper, author of Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. I'm not sure what's going on with ads these days. We don't have many at the moment, but when we do, you get the show free of ads. And you also get the fun half of the program every day. Mm-hmm. Also, don't forget, Majority Live, get your tickets. Boston, May 15th. We may have some other dates to announce soon. But May 15th, 2 p.m. in Boston. We'll see you there. You suck at hockey, but you can come and see us anyways. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie, amquickie.com, every morning. Get an email with some top stories. All right. Want to welcome to the program David Pepper, former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, author of Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. David, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Veglin.
Thank you. Good to be with you guys.
So let's I want to get into your assessment of Ohio. And you start off your piece with the voting lines that were taking place in 2020. And the only thing I could think of was Ken Blackwell, because was the sort of in the 2004 election. And I can't remember now off the top of my head the name of the voting machines, but there was closures of sites, and the voting machine was a digital voting machine. And I believe the company's was owned by a guy who was one of the co-chairs of George W. Bush's re-election campaign. But before that, I want to talk about your race in 2010 for state audit, because that seems to unlock the key, or at least your understanding of what was going on around that time.
Yeah, so it's sort of ancient history in my own mind, but not that long ago, Ohio was a state with a Democratic state house, a Democratic majority congressional delegation. And like around the country, 2010 was the race where all that changed. And after 2010, they rigged this state as much as it's ever been rigged, and they did around the country. And I happened to be running for an office in 2010, the state auditor. As unknown as that office may be, it sits on the board that draws the lines. And I go through this race in the book, you know,
draws the state house lines.
Which, as I explain in the book, while everyone focuses on the Congress, the gerrymandering of state house districts is the key to everything they're doing, because it means in states, they have basically an ability to do anything they want with no accountability. It's more important in a long-term way than even the gerrymandering of Congress, because it's through the states that they're doing most of those anti-democratic attacks. So in the Karl Rove, Koch brothers, Alec mindset, the state houses are the key. And so gerrymandering is the key. So I'm running against this total unknown guy who they kind of recruited late because the sitting auditor was recruited to be John Kasich's lieutenant governor. I outraced the guy 4 or 5 to 1. You know, I get all the endorsements, including by papers that had endorsed Kasich. And then I mentioned in the book, all of a sudden, you know, late in the race, I start seeing like all these checks, like $5 and $10. This was before online small dollar giving where it was easy, from like Utah and Illinois, little coal towns. Okay. I'm thinking, why in the world do these people care about who the state auditor of Ohio is? And it was clear when you look at it that forces that could care less about the auditor but really rely on the gerrymandered state house saw that he needed major help, and they converged to help him, ultimately help him in a big way. The party did as well. He ended up beating me. But the point was they were focused in a way that our side wasn't. I didn't get a lot of support around the country except for people I knew. They were focused in 2010, Karl Rove and many others, on this need when they were dying because Obama had just won through this broad majority to grab hold of state houses so they could control them. And we saw that play out here all around the country. And Karl Rove sort of snuck in and basically grabbed all these state houses, and the rest we've been living with ever since. And I saw it in my own race. On our side, most people could have cared less or knew very little about our process to draw maps. The other side, they knew about it so much that coal magnates were forcing miners in Utah, or staff members, I don't know if they were actual miners, to give money to a statewide race in Ohio to make sure that they could lock in that state house. And as I say, the rest is history. You've been fighting back ever since, and usually not successfully.
And we should say that in 2010, and we've spoken to a couple of people about this, Thomas Hoeffler, who was known as the godfather of gerrymandering for the Republicans, in 2010, he started running these models for different district lines. I don't know if he did one for Ohio, but that would basically show, you know, how you gerrymander these places. And the technology was such by 2010 that it was a fundamentally different process than it would have been in 2000 or any year prior. And of course, this happens every 10 years because of the census.
Right.
So tell us what the implications of this. And when we say undemocratic, what we literally mean is you just don't need as many votes. You can control the state.
Right.
And still get less votes than the other party, essentially.
Right. So you're right. So we won the state house in 2008 in Ohio, even though they had gerrymandered in 2001. I mean, back then it just wasn't as sort of locked in as it is with the new technology. So with the gerrymandering of 2011, just to be clear, so Obama, we have a great apples to apples comparison. I put this in the book. Obama won Ohio by about the same amount in 2012 as he did 2008. So we have an apples to apples. Their gerrymandering was so effective that even though Ohio was blue by about the same number, a 10-8 congressional delegation, 10 Democrat, 8 Republican, 4 years later was 12-4 the other way, and that 12-4 lasted the entire decade, even though the numbers in 8 and 12 were more or less the same. A majority Democratic state house went from mid-50s Democrat to 40s Republican to a supermajority the other way. It lasted the whole decade again. And 99% of the districts that were drawn in 2011 held to the rigging the entire decade. And it's even worse than all that. And I go through this because one of the things I'm trying to get people to understand is stop being shocked by the horrific behavior of these state houses. Texas, with what they're doing to women's reproductive rights and guns. Once you understand the makeup of these places, you will no longer be shocked, but no one's really dug in. So I said they basically rigged themselves a supermajority in Ohio all decade. And by the way, this is true all across the country. But let's say they have 60 plus seats in that supermajority no matter what. 17 of those seats for an entire decade averaged 50-point margins of victory. 22 averaged 30. You know, another 12 averaged 20. 50 seats basically were guaranteed a 20-plus margin of victory, 64 or better. The next 12 averaged 10. Like, So it's not just that they get a majority. We're dealing now with a generation of people in office their entire career who've essentially not been in a democratic system. They haven't been in real elections. So everything that we expect people in a functioning democracy to do, they're doing essentially the opposite. Their entire careers are basically as non-democratic officials who win elections that are guaranteed for them. And that's explained so much of why they keep behaving badly and why they're always attacking democracy, because they've never been in it. And they understand that if they actually faced real voters and real democracy, most of them would actually lose power. By the way, one other quick thing on how undemocratic these maps are. 18 was a blue wave. It didn't feel like that halfway through election night, but in hindsight, it was a major blue wave. And in multiple states, and this is sort of like Orban-style governance, in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in particular, Democratic voters, a majority voted decisively for state House members to be Democrats. So the majority spoke. The districts are so rigged that in those states, you still had a Republican majority, in Wisconsin, a supermajority, even though that represents a minority of the voters. That's how rigged it's been in state after state.
Okay. And so let me just restate it so that people understand it. I use this statistic quite a bit for Wisconsin just because it has stuck in my head. But in Wisconsin, if I remember correctly, the 52% of the people who went to the polls voted for a Democrat. However, in the state house, 65, I think it is.
Right.
Representatives out of 100 are Republican. So they have a 65% majority.
Correct.
In the state house, where 52% of people voted for the opposing party. And that is correct. Just the way that they're apportioned. And your argument,
it's minority rule locked in.
And
no matter what the voters do.
Is that not only is that a problem in terms of just the sheer notion of democracy that you would imagine, at least at the very least, it would be close. I mean, if a majority right. of people vote for Democrats, you would think that at least the state house would be sort of close. There wouldn't be a supermajority right. of Republicans. But you're also arguing that it has a qualitative impact on the people who are elected in right. terms of how far they're willing to go, because they know they are so unaccountable to the voters because of the nature of the gerrymandering in their particular district.
Right. And the other thing I go through, and a lot of this stuff I thought through more as I wrote, the things you do to succeed in their non-democratic gerrymandered world, you have to be as extreme as possible to fend off a primary. Public outcomes don't really matter to you because the voters aren't really given a choice anyway, but keeping the private players happy is really important to you. That's why you have so much privatization of public assets, be it for-profit charter schools, you know, the grid falling apart in Texas, you name it. So they have all these incentives in their world. Almost every one of those incentives actually behaving that way, in a real democracy, they would guarantee their loss. So they behave for years in their careers in ways that are rewarded in this non-democratic world. If they ever faced real democracy, their power would be gone. So the thing that should scare us all is these people who have every incentive to not want democracy to be robust where they are also have hands on levers of democracy. And that's why they have to re-rig the districts. They want to suppress the votes of the opposition party because they know that if they ever faced real democracy, real districts, they would lose. And by the way, one example of this that surprised people last November, at least in Ohio, which is a conservative state in many parts of our state, we had these many people running for school board, anti-vax, anti-CRT, in non-gerrymandered districts, right? Because of school board, most of them lost. They're behaving exactly like the state house members. But in a gerrymandered world, that politics feels good. But back in even a conservative neighborhood that's a school district, non-gerrymandered, the crazy all lost, or almost all of them. So they see that, they know that. They can't keep, and it sort of ratchets up together. They can't keep being as extreme as they are or give so much away to the private as they do unless they keep rigging more extremely. And then the more they rig, the more they can be extreme. And that's why the downward spiral will continue. I don't mean to be so bleak. Until we get in there to the unaccountable state houses through federal action, which they need to take, through the way we organize politically, until we bring accountability back and real democracy back in these state houses, every incentive is for them to just keep doing what they're doing and frankly go in even worse directions. And we've seen that acceleration, especially after Democrats started winning statewide in 16. We are seeing the acceleration of this extremism on democracy, on issues, especially as they've been threatened by statewide officials. You know, Governor Evers won in 18. He won a majority. What did that minority do? They started attacking the powers of the guy who'd actually won a majority of the vote. And so and that's what they're doing now with elections officials. Like, it just keeps going and going. We have to get to the heart of the problem, which is these unaccountable state houses, or it will keep going.
What's your response to states like Illinois, where Democrats were miraculously, in some cases, because it, you know, Republicans dominate state houses, able to gain power and then are participating in kind of offensive defense by gerrymandering themselves? To me, it's like a little too late, but also speaks to the rod of the system that you talk about.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is I think gerrymandering leads to very poor outcomes long term, no matter what. I mean, you want a robust democracy. I understand that in a world where there aren't rules, you're going to have a race to the bottom. And if Ohio and Texas are all doing it, Illinois is going to do it. And this is why I'm still so upset that they didn't pass a couple weeks ago what they need to pass in Washington, because that would establish the Freedom to Vote Act, John Lewis Act, included ground rules that would stop gerrymandering from happening everywhere. So there isn't a temptation that can be understandable to compete with the Republican gerrymandering through Democratic gerrymandering and would actually clean it up for everybody. And in the end, you know, I'm a Democrat, but I'm also about good results for everyday people and good representation. And you just don't get that in a gerrymandered world, wherever it is. Now, I will say, you know, a lot of Democratic state houses probably don't meet every standard of good government, but they certainly aren't attacking democracy every day in the way the Republicans are. So I'm not going to also do a both sides to it. But ideally, what you would have, and frankly, our big win in Ohio a couple weeks ago showed this is possible, you would have standards in place that make it so that neither side can truly, you know, seize and keep power through rigging districts. And in the end, you know, if Illinois got a blue legislature, it's because that's how people vote, which they do. Michigan would be probably blue. Ohio would probably go back and forth. And these people would actually have incentives to be good public officials. A gerrymandered world gives them incentives to do almost the opposite of everything we would want in a good public official.
Let's talk about some of those things that are problematic that you write about in the book that are Ohio specific, but I imagine would also apply to other states with this same dynamic. And we should say, you know, I think, like, you know, from my perspective, it has always been the case that the smaller the government, the more opportunity there is for there to be this type of corruption, because frankly, there's less oversight. There's a lack of media, and we can talk about some of the ideas that you had at the end in terms of the way you deal with this. There's just more opportunity. You get a bigger bang for your buck when you're looking to buy essentially a politician at that level.
Right. Yeah. And two things: the founding fathers, and as I put in the book, they worried about that. The founding fathers believed, James Madison wrote, and I'll say it my way, that state houses were the potential backdoor to undermine our nation's democracy because of certain fundamental weaknesses with that smaller level of government, much more anonymous than federal or even local mayors might be. And guess who discovered the same thing? The Koch brothers and Alec. These state houses, for a combination of reasons, they have a lot of power over democracy, as put in the Constitution. They have a lot of power over substance, you know, energy, taxes, workers, you name it, the environment, social policy. But almost no average people are paying attention to these places. They can't even name their state rep. But ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Koch brothers, the NRA, and everyone else figured out, my God, these are the best places. We can go to them. We can get things done that in most cases are highly unpopular, that we would never get done in Congress. We can get them done in the state house, and half the time, no one even knows. So, yeah, they've become in many ways the Achilles heel of governance, because you know they're very weak in terms of people understanding what they're doing, but they're very strong in terms of what they can actually do, and that ends up being the true problem. And Democrats, and I would say, have contributed to this, and I say this with respect, but because we get so focused on the excitement of a presidential campaign or a few Senate seats, that's what we give our money to, that's what we organize around, that's when we show up to vote. The Koch brothers have decided we want to win the presidency if we can, but they don't care if someone's a boring, you know, do nothing legislator in Columbus. If that person's voting for their agenda, they're getting what they want to get done. So these state houses have literally become the vehicle of doing almost everything they need to do. And this is why the filibuster discussion is so frustrating. They don't care if Washington does nothing. All they need out of Washington are judges to uphold these state laws and a few other things, because almost their entire agenda of trickle-down economics and so much that goes with it is actually totally fulfillable through state houses. And that's what they're doing right now. Until everyone else figures it out, they're going to keep winning that game.
Is there also not a problem that, I mean, you know, Democratic voters are not paying attention to this on some level, but also there is a lack of a statewide structure within the Democratic Party. There, we also have this problem of a ossified, at best, a semi-corrupt, if you ask me, at worst, a sort of consultant class, who there's a lot more money to be made in a federal election than a state election. There's a lot more money to be made in a sort of like a nationalized, whether it's ad buys or whatever it is. And so there's all these incentives incentives to not look towards the states and and lack of incentives to look towards the states.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get in the consultant. I never have, believe it or not, penetrated that consultant world that much. But I will simply say, I mean, there are groups, you know, Eric Holder's is one, working with President Obama, DLCC and others that are emerging, trying to sort of make this case. And they started to make it the last couple of years. They were very helpful in our effort, for example, to deal with this gerrymandering, which we've done somewhat successfully. But these are one-off programs as opposed to the mindset of the entire effort. The heart of what the other side is doing is state houses first, get them gerrymandered, make them undemocratic. Everything flows from that power. On our side, it's still, even though some are trying, it's really late in the game. But if you look at where resources are going, to your point, you know, it's almost entirely going to go to the multi-$100 million Senate campaigns. And then some scraps back in states, even though, by the way, smaller amounts of money go so much further at the state level. It's state house races, it's state organizing. Karl Rove's operation in 2010 that won so many states was a $30 million budget. You're spending billions in a presidential race. And that's why I put in the book, if you took a single-digit percentage of your presidential spend and divvied it up over 4 years, and you said, we're going to invest this in democracy-supporting efforts in local races, state house races, in all states. Not only would you have an enormous, like, better chance of succeeding there, I also think you have a better chance of winning the presidential race every 4 years because you've built that infrastructure. My guess is some people hear that and think, well, that's crazy. Who would ever do that? And the answer is the Koch brothers. That's what they did. They right. literally said, we're going to spread our money across all states. Every single year, the heart of democracy is these state houses. We're going to win them, and then we're going to clinch them through gerrymandering and other law changes. It's worked like a charm for them. Win or lose federal, they are winning at the state level. We have to, whatever the consultant looks like or whatever else, we have to not have these be Eric Holder's program, someone else's program. It's got to be the mindset of the entire operation, or we'll continue to lose the battle.
And just to remind people, you know, I think was it David Koch who was spending a tremendous amount of money as early as, like, I believe the early 1980s on the Libertarian Party. I mean, so this has been a 40-year multi a more than multi-million dollar project for them. I mean, tens upon tens upon tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars that they have spent. Five or six years ago, we were talking about how they had created essentially a parallel party structure to the Republican Party. And the problem is that even for the Democrats, there isn't the same incentive for any billionaire out there to do that, both because they don't have the ideological disposition, and they don't get, you know, I mean, the Koch brothers have the, I think they're genuinely ideologues, but they also, there's a return on their investment.
Right. Exactly. For them, it's an investment. It pays back multiple times over, at least. But no, that's what they did. And by the way, if you read Jane Mayer's Dark Money, which I cited a number of times in my book, they also understood, you know, it's interesting. The libertarian effort was a failure. I think David Koch ran for president and he lost. Vice president. And that's when he decided it's not going to work this way. We've got to go through the Republican Party. The other observation they made, though, and they figured out that their agenda was not popular. That agenda would never succeed in a world of a robust democracy. People trickled on economics. It's too much have and have not. It just, you know, it just doesn't work. They know it doesn't work for most people. So they figured out we're only going to get what we need to get done in a world where democracy is subverted. And they also figured out state houses are a really good place to get unpopular things passed because, again, no one's paying attention. These state house members are driven by all the worst incentives. So their state house strategy is also driven by a keen observation that almost nothing they stand for would actually do well in a world of robust democracy. So state house after state house after state house, if you want to do something really bad, you know, a crazy gun law that only 15% of a people support, attack Roe v. Wade, which most people don't support, you do it through a state house because those state house members are so unaccountable. Not only will it pass, even if it gets struck down by court, the people who voted for it will get reelected. And they know that. So the Koch brothers really knew, and there are quotes I put in the book. They are acknowledging our agenda is really not that popular. In a real democracy, it would never happen. We must, therefore, go to the least democratic institutions to get it done. And by the way, we can use those institutions to keep democracy at bay more broadly, and that's what they're doing.
And
they say it in the open.
And if you control the federal courts, all they need to do is basically unshackle these states and the states
totally.
Can they want it.
That's what they need. The reason they don't want a filibuster for judges is because that's the one thing most important. If they're leading everything through state houses, which they are, the one thing they can't afford is federal courts stopping them or federal legislation. So you apply the filibuster to stop the federal legislation. But you don't apply it for judges because you do need judges to uphold all these crazy laws that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, most of these attacks on voting rights wouldn't even have happened because the Voting Rights Act wouldn't have allowed it. But you need federal courts to basically give a red carpet to all this crazy stuff.
Just briefly, before we get into some of the ideas in which, you know, to correct these problems. Talk about the dynamic where they literally function as laboratories, like where they roll this stuff out in the state.
Right.
Years ago when I was on the radio, I'd talk about some piece of legislation that was introduced in Indiana and I distinctly remember getting criticized in the press for like highlighting the kook in the Indiana State House, and then I don't know, 10 years later that person is running some agency in the U.S. Right. In the federal government, or the law is now like the law of the land in 3 states or 5 states or 10 states. Talk about that dynamic.
Sure. So obviously the title of the book is Laboratories of Autocracy, and autocracy maybe is the word that sticks out. But as I try and prove out in the book, they are literally functioning as laboratories. These and they can do it again because they can do repeated attempts at things, as unpopular as those things are, and never lose the election because of the gerrymandering. So they can do it over and over and over again. So what you see happening is they're always learning. If something passes and it gets upheld by a court, a whole lot of other states will be doing it in a few years. If it proves to be terribly unpopular in a way that actually costs them, like in Ohio, they tried to jam through at the end of collective bargaining and they included police and fire unions in it. It was terribly unpopular. Every future attempt in other states to attack collective bargaining left out police and fire unions based upon the Ohio experience. So if something is struck down, they update the way the law is written in that state and other states so it won't get struck down again. So they're always in much more sort of around elections. They're also always seeing quickly, why did they lose an election? They saw how Obama organized in 08. So they quickly, when they have a chance in 11, start tearing away at early vote and the opportunity to vote on Sundays and the opportunity to register and vote the same day. They go after the exact reasons they lost an election and they change the rules so they don't lose that election in the future. We're seeing that right now with drop boxes. No one ever cared about drop boxes. They've been all over a lot of states, Alaska, Utah for years. But in 20, voters of color disproportionately used them. They were a big reason Biden won in places like Wisconsin and Georgia. What do? They're targeting the way that, that voters of color who don't vote for them vote. So they're always learning from each other, from themselves, from what they're watching. And by the way, they will learn from January 6th as well. Why did it not work? How do they fix it? So they really are operating as laboratories. And again, the reason they're able to is because they're so, you know, comfortable in state houses that are rigged for them. They could just keep going over and over and over again. And since they're never held accountable, if they fail twice or three times or four times, on the fifth time, they succeed. And we've seen that in Ohio. So I start the book out with the Secretary of State here passed a rule late in the election, one drop box per county. And I joke that this led to traffic jams Chris Christie would be proud of. Okay. All over the state, massive traffic jams. Any normal public official would say, we don't want traffic jams around voting. That's terrible. But in this world of laboratories of autocracy, what happens? A whole bunch of states see those traffic jams, understand how hard it's going to make it for certain people to vote. They pass laws all this year mimicking that rule. So in the future, they too will have congested drop boxes, early vote locations. So that's one example where they're literally learning from, I'd call, the worst practices that help their agenda.
What, let's get to some of the 30 ideas that you give for reclaiming democracy. Is it the state level that you perceive it as being the most important at this point?
I mean, I will say, I think we can never give up on the effort to push for the federal protection through legislation as much as they voted last week. I mean, there is a pretty bleak history. And, you know, one of the key analogies, and some are saying it and others are criticizing for it, but it's just a fact. The exact pattern we're seeing is the exact pattern of elements that led to Jim Crow. And I won't go through all the details, but and it was the failure of the federal government to act at key moments that allowed, in the end, Jim Crow to set in. So we should never give up on the federal responsibility that the founders actually wrote in the Constitution. They guaranteed basically democratic governance in states. They said the United States guarantees a Republican form of government in states. That was the clause right before they guaranteed that states would be protected from foreign invasion. So these senators have an obligation to protect democracy in states. So we have, so that's key, and we have to keep pushing for it. But beyond that, yes, when we think about how we're politically organizing and thinking, we have to go from this federal battlefield that we often are obsessed with, you know, that it's all about a majority in Congress and the presidency. We have to win those, of course. But we have to realize that this is no longer just, you know, an assumption of an intact democracy where federal election is the goal of those elections. But it's actually a battle for democracy itself. And once you realize it's that, then you realize, well, the key to democracy is actually these state houses. They set the rules. They draw the districts. Once you make the adjustment that this is a battle for democracy itself, which Democrats and others like-minded have not really been thinking about in those terms, that's how the Koch brothers think about it. That means you all of a sudden are changing your focus to be about states across this country, about levels of office far below Congress and Senate and presidency. You should be, you know, building your team according to that thinking, spending your resources, organizing in a permanent way, or like they are doing, And if you simply keep playing this every couple year federal game while they're doing everything else, well, obviously they're gonna win. So there needs to be a major adjustment politically, and almost every other step flows from changing that sort of framework of what the battle looks like.
But isn't the problem? I don't know what the solution is for this, but it's one thing to say like the Koch brothers,
right?
Two guys, one is dead
right.
now.
Right.
But two guys sit around right. with a couple of you know, their whatever their brain trust is, you know, and contemplate this, or maybe they, you know, Karl Rove contacts them and says, you know, I need the bankrolling. Here's my idea, right. and it's a completely top down process, and for them to contemplate an electoral strategy that is really just about process, right? I mean, because right. at the end of the day, they're like, we don't need to push this type of legislation first. That flows if we set up a system like this, and we right. set up a process like that. There is no analog to the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
And so how does that happen? Because we're not going to have a million Democratic voters, let's say, or just voters who are going to say, well, I know to send my $5 check to this guy who's running for state auditor in Ohio. That's, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, we had some of that in 2016 in response. There were groups that were sort of like self-organizing and doing that, but I don't know how sustainable that is.
Yeah, I mean, you do need, so my book was sort of intended for many audiences, and you do need some large players to come around and say, who have resource, and say, we are gonna try and lead at a high level, an equivalent of what the other side has done, and fund it accordingly. You also, though, need, you know, as I put in the book, this is not just for the Senate or those high value people who can put money behind something big. There's also an adjustment that everyone else can make that I put in the book. But yeah, I agree that the forces on the right have essentially privatized a lot of sort of the party process, and they just do what they want to do. And there isn't the equivalent here. And if there are major people involved, which there are, each of them does their own thing. It's not like there's a coordinated effort. I do think that's one of the reasons why one side is doing it better than the other. I think major players have to figure out that democracy itself is at stake and be planning accordingly. And, you know, to the extent my book gets in their hands, I hope they read it. Because when I say in my book, take some part of what's given to the presidential election and divide it up over 4 years and invest it in a broader state strategy, that's who I'm trying to talk to.
Right.
And if they don't figure it out, you're right. It will be very hard at that level to do it. But I will say in the book, though, for everyone who isn't a billionaire or a U.S. senator, there are many things that any individual can do, whether you're the mayor, whether you're just a grassroots activist, which is the heart of all of it, whether you're on a homeless shelter board. One of the things I put in the book is sort of a challenge that I myself, you know, undertook by doing the book. Every single person has a footprint in the world. And every person, I hope, even though we're almost done with January, will make a resolution for the new year that they will use their footprint in any way that they can think of to lift democracy. And just a few examples of this. There is no reason, you know, in a state like Ohio, every city, the voters of these cities, our large urban cities, are the ones being purged by horrible purging processes. Every mayor should take offense that their citizens are being purged in this democracy, and should every aspect of city government that interfaces with those voters should be registering right now. Rec centers, health clinics, you know, you name it, the libraries. If you're on the board of a food bank, are you registering your constituents when they come to the food bank? Because we know the other side is purging them. A public housing, public transportation. The one thing we can all do is figure out in our, and not just registering, but engaging in our little neck of the world, what can all of us do? Because I worry the model we have is too much waiting for Stacey Abrams to save us with some nonprofit that registers voters, or Michelle Obama. Those are great efforts, one-off efforts to register. But how we'll really do better is if we literally put in the bloodstream of what we all do every day. You know, you run a restaurant, you run a barbershop, Are you registering the people who are your value customers who are being purged? So there's my hope is beyond the big people and the big shots and what they do. And again, it's just one book, but I hope other people talk the same way. Everyone can start to push back, put their money where democracy is, subscribe to your local or state paper that covers this stuff. You know, figure out who your state house candidate is or who's opposing a bad one. Everyone needs to start paying attention to this if we're going to fight back. And so much of the reason why we're losing in this broader fight for democracy is one side is very focused on undermining it. And everyone else who I think cares about it is either taking it for granted or not paying enough attention to realize there's a fight taking place and they need to get in it.
David Pepper. Book is Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today.
I really appreciate it. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Now, I neglected to do this up front, and I apologize. And I've been saving this email for a week.
Oh.
I know you got to get going. Just give me one second.
Yeah. No, it's okay.
At the beginning of last Wednesday, we talked about... suggested that you had coined the term hump day.
Mm-hmm.
We got an email from listener Scott. Dear Emma, as a boomer, I've known about the phrase hump day all my life.
Do you know if I'm immortal or not?
Here's a link documenting that has been common for 70 years. So I have some bad news for you. You did not coin the term hump day.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but you don't know how old I am, and until you independently verify it, you still cannot say I didn't come up with it.
There you go. All right. Emma's going to step out, although she may come back soon.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
After time.
And in the meantime, I'm going to head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it's your support that will... keeps this program going. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Two guests tonight. We're having Marshall Steinbaum from the University of Utah on to talk about how actually getting forgiving student loan debt would not be regressive, as a Brookings institution elites like to tell you. And also we'll have Bob Leibel. He's running for Travis County commissioner. And so David Griscom has an interview with him. We're talking about local politics. So patreon.com/leftreckoning for that stuff tonight. We're also going to talk about the Jordan Peterson climate thing.
Oh, yeah. Shoot. We didn't get to that. Maybe we'll get to it later. But when we come back, got a little break in format. Got somebody who wanted to debate me. When we come back, we will have that. Be right back after this.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang.
a hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total pussy.